Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. This week, we're going to talk about creating and developing AI workflows in the newsroom. Generative AI has been all the rage for the last few years because, at least within news, it has opened up so many new creative and imaginative possibilities. It has also improved many existing automation tools like transcription, translation, and synthetic voices. AI has also never been more accessible to pick up and play with, as new tools are often simple, cheap, and intuitive to use. Newsrooms of all sizes are looking to harness the new tech, but face different barriers that keep them from jumping in. And although applications for AI within journalism are growing, newsrooms still need to be selective with what makes the most sense for them. Here to unpick this with me is David Caswell, founder of innovation consultancy Storyflow and a former executive product manager at BBC News Labs in a role focused on AI-based initiatives. So where do you start introducing AI into your newsroom? How do you empower journalists to use the technology? How do you balance the need to be fast with the need to be responsible? All of these questions and more will be answered, so don't go anywhere. David, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. Thank you ever so much for coming onto our show.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
We're here today to talk a lot about generative AI, which has been the subject of a lot of our focus here in the news industry over the last few years, where it's really become sort of in the mainstream consciousness. But of course, AI has kind of been around in journalism for decades at this point. So I wonder if just a place to kind of kick off the conversation would be, what's fundamentally different with generative AI compared to what we've historically seen with this technology?
The one that people focus on quite obviously is the generative part of it. The fact that these models, these language models and other models can create media and can create media with quite an amazing degree of control through, you know, text prompts, for example, or other kinds of inputs. But then the other thing I think that's changed is for the last 10 or 15 years or so, as news organizations, and usually we're talking about very large news organizations here, as they've sort of got into quote-unquote AI or machine learning, you know, deep learning and so on, it's been in a very specialized and expensive way. In large media organizations, this would typically start, you know, 2010 kind of era. Big data was all the rage, you know, the cloud was new. These organizations started to build data warehouses, recruiting data scientists and data engineers. These were very expensive and difficult recruitments and, you know, forming these little teams. And those teams would typically work on proprietary in-house models. They would train models from scratch using the various techniques that were around at the time. And the models that they would train would be proprietary again, but also kind of very restricted or very specific to very narrow tasks. So these would be things like recommender systems, you know, for doing some kind of curation of rails of content to recommend, for example. They would be things like subscription models were a very big part of this. So things like churn models or propensity to convert models, dynamic paywall models, these kind of things. And these were all very specific. This new generation of AI is not like that at all. It's based not on narrow proprietary models, but on very general, very open models. General in the fact that, you know, you can type anything you want into ChatGPT and get a response, you know, or Midjourney or any other of these things. So that, you know, the generality is extreme. So you're not just dealing with one narrow task. You're dealing with many tasks. You know, the imagination of the task is the hard part now. They're so general. And the second thing is the accessibility. You know, if you can afford $20 a month, you can get access to ChatGPT Plus with all of the magic that comes from that. You know, the accessibility isn't restricted by, you know, lack of coding knowledge or lack of data science. And so it's open to vastly more people, both inside news organizations and then obviously everybody else as well, than the previous era of AI was.
Yeah. So would it be fair to say that really it's been democratized in a sense, in that
yes,
there's less of a skill gap, there's an ease of access, it's more affordable, you know, it's basically more open to generalists?
Yes, that is exactly the word. It's open to everybody. It really is a step function in accessibility that takes it from the purview of maybe a few tens of thousands of specialists to billions of people, basically. I don't know what the latest numbers are for ChatGPT usage, but I think they're north of 200 million people in a year. The democratization is extreme in this case.
Right. And for a lot of the tasks that we were previously using AI for, whether that's synthetic voice, translation, transcription, that's all becoming better with generative AI. But also generative AI is bringing a bunch of new possibilities, a bunch of new things that might have previously not been possible. Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of this kind of goes back to a single paper that came out of Google Research in 2017. And it was the kind of the foundational paper, I guess, of the generative AI era. Basically, a lot of these models and systems were reinvented on the basis of that transformer architecture that was described first in that paper. And as a result, became dramatically better. So we went from synthetic voices, for example, that were clearly synthetic. You know, they were good. You could understand them. But there was no doubt that they were, you know, they were machines. We went from that to synthetic voices that are absolutely indistinguishable from human voices. Like, you know, the way I'm speaking right now is absolutely possible to recreate in a synthetic voice. And the same thing with transcription, and the same thing with translation, and all of these things where we had an early taste of this, say in the 2016, 2017, 2018 era, using these very specialized models. But now we've got this whole other approach to it that has, you know, step functioned or dramatically increased the quality of what they can do.
Right. Super interesting. And, you know, we spoke there about the democratization of this technology. You would think that that puts smaller, more entrepreneurial newsrooms at a slight advantage because they're more easily able to start experimenting with this technology. You know, when we think about larger legacy news publishers, one of the consistent things we hear about that when it comes to rolling out any sort of a project is the amount of barriers and the amount of bureaucracy it takes to get those ideas off the ground. And that, you know, conversely means that the smaller news organizations are kind of at an advantage in this space.
Yeah, I think that's a very profound insight. I think that there's a lot of assumptions still that smaller local news is disadvantaged, or, you know, news organizations in the global south are disadvantaged. And I think that is misreading the situation. Radical democratization is disproportionately advantaging, as you've implied there, smaller, more agile, more imaginative organizations with less to lose, perhaps. They're not kind of bringing the legacy products and the legacy audience. And the new sort of scarce resource is that agility and imagination and, you know, willingness to take some risks. Moderated, of course, there's a lot of, you know, ways that this can go very wrong for a news organization. So risk-taking in a moderate way is useful. Whereas the older, larger legacy news organizations, their risk tolerance is different. They do have infrastructure and organizational capacity that's very geared towards this older, more narrow form of AI, and kind of, you know, reimagining what AI is or what it can be used for in this new kind of nimble user interfaces and APIs kind of world, rather than kind of building your own models kind of world. They're still working through a lot of that. So I think my own view is that we're going to see smaller organizations lead in terms of what's possible, you know, with these new kinds of AI.
Good ideas need to get off the ground, so nimble newsrooms are at an advantage when it comes to developing AI workflows. This is something David knows well, as towards the end of last year, he was involved in an accelerator called the AI in Journalism Challenge, which sought to understand what digitally native, mission-focused, low-staff newsrooms can do if given the tools, support, and freedom to run with generative AI. 12 news organizations were picked out from 113 applications, and they gained an intensive bootcamp session in producing AI-powered news products, along with expert mentoring and enough funding to cover the costs involved. It was a competition, and it was Rappler in the Philippines that came out as winners for developing its TLDR model. This converts news stories into a range of multimedia content for Gen Z and millennial news consumers. But that's just one possibility with generative AI. The program saw a breadth of projects based around news gathering, efficiencies, and contextualization.
That were building systems that read content at scale and then summarized that. Some of them were doing it for the purposes of monitoring how they were making an impact, or they were trying to track their own journalism as it kind of went through the ecosystem, but two of them were doing this for a kind of a news gathering objective. There were a couple of cases where news organizations were building kind of new distribution channels out of this. So Rappler was one of those. Rappler have a new channel that they're developing called TLDR, which is a young audience channel. They're trying to take the output from their newsroom and then reformat that into video and comics and, you know, simpler forms of text or easier, concise forms of text. And they're trying to do that to target younger audiences through this entirely new brand. And then there was a somewhat similar one from a news organization called The Conversation, which is kind of a global news organization that focuses on work that's usually written by experts in whatever the subject matter is. They set up a system of microsites on very narrow topics. So this kind of long tail of microsites, which fits very well with their model. So these were new channels that these organizations were able to develop because they could now, you know, reversion content in this much simpler, easier way, whereas you just could never do that manually, at the scale that these organizations work at. There were a few efficiency-focused projects, but not many. I think there was only two of the 12 participants were basically trying to make existing tasks like search engine optimization more efficient. The rest of them were doing fairly out there things. There was two projects in particular which got an honorable mention from the judges. This was Question Publica from Colombia, and their system was basically kind of a whole new kind of journalism. And their ODIN project essentially takes advantage of a data set that they've constructed, essentially a knowledge graph of the elites in Colombian society, the politicians, the businesses, the relationships, and all that. They've got this sort of big data set that describes all of that. And they built this system called ODIN, which allows them to take breaking news very, very quickly, you know, almost instantly contextualize that in terms of, you know, these relationships and connections among the elites in Colombia. So they can, you know, they know, you know, who's sitting on whose board and, you know, what family relationships are and who went to school with who and all this kind of stuff. And so they can take some breaking news. They can instantly, you know, make all these connections. And then the output from that was social media posts. So they could do these very, very fast social media stories, you know, threads and tweets and all the rest of it. So something would break and then, boom, here's some very deeply referenced, contextualized version of that, you know, how it applies to Colombian society.
Mm. There's tons of really good examples there. And I feel like what maybe unites a lot of those is that there's such a specific targeted purpose for a lot of the examples you shared there, normally around like contextualizing certain events, which is something that would take a lot of people to do, and I imagine that's a clear upside to doing it within a smaller team, because, you know, that really would help them in a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think the reality in traditional newsrooms is that a lot of that is held within people's minds.
Right.
You know, you've got an individual or a small number of individuals who have just been through all the stories, and they can see something and say, oh, you know, this person knows this person, or it's all just sort of in somebody's mind, and then they retire or something, or kind of, you know, quit and move somewhere else.
Then it's lost, yeah.
And it's lost, right? And so I think, you know, what the Question Publica ODIN project points towards is a way to sort of externalize that context, maybe, and make it, you know, maybe not in the same degree or with the same nuance that you can with a person, but at some level, so that it remains accessible permanently.
So it's about preservation, really, of knowledge, of experience, of coverage.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. You know, if you can develop and maintain the body of material, you know, with which to contextualize, whether it's an archive or whether it's a knowledge graph, for example, then you've got this permanent record that you can kind of go back to.
Just a quick one from me, and then we'll get back to the show. Join us on the 22nd of May at our next Digital Journalism Conference, NewsRewired, in London. If you're enjoying this episode, and I hope you are, you might be interested in a session which explores practical applications to AI, and there's plenty more to come on newsletters, young audiences, fact-checking, and much, much more. I'll be there with the team, and I'd love to see you there too. Head over to newsrewired.com for the full agenda and to grab your place today. So we spoke there before about potentially larger news organizations being at a disadvantage in this space because there's considerably more barriers and layers they need to go through. But, you know, there's good reasons for having those silos, though, and that's because they're probably aware of, you know, the dangers of getting some of these projects wrong with AI. But I guess a lesson throughout this is that, you know, in this space, the playing field has been leveled, and, you know, publishers of all sizes kind of need to be careful about stepping into this space. Is that something that's really kind of been on your mind lately?
Yes, there's an awful lot of ways that this can go badly for different news organizations, so it is appropriate to be cautious. There's a potential misunderstanding here as well. So, you know, a lot of the irresponsible uses of AI in news-related publishing, a lot of that is going to come from small organizations, because there's going to be, there already is, a lot of people that can now, you know, hook up a few APIs, you know, set up a website and do things that are maybe not ethical, not responsible. That does not mean that small news organizations as a whole are irresponsible. In fact, you know, the ones that we worked with in the AI and Journalism Challenge, or most of them, were absolutely fully as aware of and as prepared for the risks and the challenges ethically and in terms of their value and their journalistic integrity as large news organizations. So organizations like Agência Pública in Brazil, like Rappler, they have comprehensive guidelines. They've thought it through. They've developed an approach to this that corresponds with their values and responsibilities. So just because they're small doesn't mean they're going to be irresponsible. That's the point I'm kind of making here. Whereas large organizations, they typically have a lot to lose. They've got a brand, you know, often hundreds of years old. They've got a trust basis in a large audience that's been built over generations, basically. You know, they've got social responsibilities and societal responsibilities and whatever the market that they're in, whereas a startup, you know, might not have developed that yet. But at the same time, there are opportunities here to serve those missions and those values and those responsibilities as well as risks. I think that's where the asymmetry is here. You know, the smaller organizations, they can say, right, we've got this set of risks and potential harms here that we have to consider and manage, but we've also got these opportunities to serve our mission, to a broader degree or a deeper degree or whatever it happens to be. Whereas the larger organizations perhaps, you know, might be a little more focused on the risks and maybe a little less focused on, well, how can we use this to sort of take the core of what we're here for, basically, and make that much, much broader or much, much deeper or whatever it is that they do.
I wonder if there's a middle ground, David, between shaking off some of the weight, becoming a bit more agile in order to move at speed in this space, whilst also preserving standards and not going in blind, as it were, and being really messy and irresponsible in this space.
Yeah, I think that's the way it likely has to work for larger, more established organizations, is they have to find ways to be more agile. And I know, you know, at some level in all big corporations, this is almost a cliche, but it's true, right? I mean, they have to find ways to be more agile. They have to maybe be more comfortable with risk, or maybe have different ways to manage risk that allows them to try things and be more experimental. I think this is just part and parcel of what it's going to take to take advantage or to take full advantage of these tools. It's not just a defensive activity. It's an opportunity as well. I mean, you look at Rappler, for example, in the AIJC competition with this TLDR channel. That's a whole new channel intended to reach younger audiences, right? And that challenge of reaching younger audiences, that's one that's going to be very familiar to most, you know, large publishers and broadcasters. Well, you know, here you go, right? Here's a way to do that. If you do it right, if you manage it correctly, keep those values and ethical guidelines and editorial guidelines, but also, you know, see the opportunity and move towards it, then you get the best of both worlds.
Are silos a good idea?
You know, we've been in this sort of corporate era in news organizations where breaking down silos has been necessary, because, you know, you need so many people to do anything that you have to have these relationships and trust and connections and all the rest of it to make stuff work. A lot of these tools, they essentially deliver autonomy to the people that can really learn how to use them in a productive, responsible way. And so you don't necessarily need all the people. You don't need maybe as many illustrators. You don't need maybe as many people for video production and so on. And so what that may do is make teams or even individuals much more autonomous. And so then the question is, well, You know, if you've got all of these sort of connections and processes within an organization, is that still moving the organization forward in its mission, in its ability to deliver value for its audience? The audience are the only ones that count in the end. Or, you know, might it be better to allow smaller teams, for example, or desks to become much more agile using the tools that they now have in the same way that the Rapplers or the Question Publicas of the world are doing?
So larger newsrooms have the capacity to develop AI workflows at a greater scale, but good ideas can get bogged down in the decision-making process. One possible way to overcome this is with specialist silos that have the autonomy to test and learn. Obviously, this is easier said than done, as the same newsrooms are worried about the danger of generative AI producing misinformation and their long-standing reputation being damaged. Picking your battles here could be a wise move. Generative AI's impact on the information ecosystem is one of the key aims of another program David is currently involved with called AI in Journalism Futures. The main idea is to start thinking about how the entire news value chain, news gathering, news production, and news consumption, will be disrupted in the next 5 to 15 years. The call-out received close to 900 submissions, and 40 of the best arguments will be taken forward into a two-day scenario planning workshop next month. No final decisions have yet been made, but this is what David has gleaned so far.
I think there's quite a range in terms of, you know, small changes to the existing ecosystem to the very, very radical changes that might happen. So I think people are thinking about it right across the incremental to transformational spectrum. And I'm going to say this very loosely here, but I think there's roughly a balance, I think, between let's call them dystopian versus utopian views. There definitely is a lot of people that are, you know, oh my God, the whole information ecosystem is going to collapse. And some of those are quite thoughtful, and there's really good cases there, right? You know, there's multiple ways where bad things might happen. But I'm also seeing quite a few scenarios where there's relatively positive views of what the information ecosystem might become in this environment. And again, multiple ways in what might happen. So again, you know, in the spectrum of dystopian to utopian, there's quite a breadth across that spectrum as well, which is very interesting.
I'd love it if you could leave our audience just with one parting thought. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is quite hard to think about, and a lot of the solutions may not even have crossed our mind yet. It's very hard to come up with this from thin air. In terms of thinking about the possibilities here, something that we've spoken about previously, which really helped me think about this problem in a different way, is how do we strip this right down to its fundamental atoms, really, with this technology, going back to the first principles. Tell our audience a bit about that, if you would.
You know, I don't think any of us have any clarity, really, on kind of how this is going to play out, but it's likely going to be profound. The question, I think, for news organizations is, well, okay, you know, we've got this uncertainty. We don't know where all this is going. It's also, we know it's big, right? We've got this idea that it's transformational. Well, what can we do with our planning, with our strategy? There's kind of two almost competing approaches to this. I'm going to argue that they're actually not competing. They seem to be competing, but they're not. One of them is to incrementally improve, essentially, what we already do. And we can get advantages from that. We can save money. We can do more. We can maybe even enter new markets. We can do all that kind of stuff. But if we're going to be transformational about this, if we're going to deal with this transformation that's coming, news organizations are going to have to do more than that eventually. And the way to think about that, I'm going to suggest, is by kind of breaking down the core mission that a news organization has into its fundamentals, and then reimagining what you would build from that, given the presence of AI in the world, and not just for you, but for everybody, you know, in a world of democratized news gathering, democratized production, and sort of these very new forms of consumption, what might you build? You know, what would you do if you had tens of thousands of reporters who could read and listen to, you know, everything? You know, what would you do if you could distribute your journalism in basically kind of any form of media or style that you choose to do? What is that defensible thing that would be very, very hard for others or for AI to do? Or you know, these are the kind of things that I think news organizations have to be thinking about. Some people have been thinking about this for some time. Like, this, it's new to a lot of people. You know, the launch of ChatGPT has woken everybody up to the fact that this is real. But there's quite a few people in the news industry who've been kind of considering these questions for quite some time. One person that I would point you to is Gina Chua. She was a senior editor at Reuters, and she's now the editor-in-chief of Semaphore. She's been thinking about this since, I think, 2010, and has a blog where she's recorded all that thought all along the years. And name of the blog is The Structure of News. It's a first principles view of what is news in this AI-facilitated world. And there's others. You know, I've tried to contribute a little myself in research work that I've done around the sort of the semantics of sort of news as an information form. We're not all kind of starting from scratch here. There are papers to read and blogs to read and all that. But the thing that you need is this willingness to reconsider the status quo, to just imagine a world where, well, maybe you don't organize the newsroom like this, or maybe you have a completely different relationship with your audiences, or maybe, you know, the core thing that you do switches from this thing that you're very familiar with to maybe this other thing that you're not very familiar with. That willingness or that mental agility or even imagination to kind of break down, you know, really honestly, you know, what is it that you actually do, and then rebuild that for this world where these tools exist.
I love that fundamental question there, which is, if you could destroy and rebuild the way that you work, your newsroom processes, what would that look like? And, you know, how would you change it? So I think that's a nice question to kind of leave our audience with, David.
One last one of this. I wouldn't use the word destroy. You know, I think there's a middle ground here. This is going to take time. I think it's going to be relatively quickly, but it will take time. The kind of the sweet spot here, especially for large news organizations, is to find strategies that let you both take advantage of these tools for these efficiency-based or near-term opportunities, doing things more cheaply or you know, expanding your products or whatever it is, to take advantage of those now, or like in the next year or whatever, but also at the same time, with the same set of investments and the same reprioritization, also prepare for this uncertain future that's coming. And there are ways that that can be done. You know, there's, as I say, there's a lot of thinking that's been done in this already, but also just sort of, you know, orienting your infrastructure, your organization towards flexibility and towards the development of options for response to whatever way this goes.
Right, got it. Maybe chisel and rebuild then instead. But David, listen, thanks ever so much for coming on our show today. A real blast to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you again for inviting me.
My takeaway for today is for your newsroom to play to its strengths. Smaller newsrooms can get AI projects off the ground quicker, but they need to be more selective over which applications matter. Conversely, larger newsrooms have greater capacity to branch out, but can be slower to launch. Both sizes of newsrooms face the same responsibility, though. It is up to everyone to try to strike a balance between being fast and getting it right. How do you do that? David left us with a great tip today. Break down one aspect of the news value chain and then reimagine it with generative AI involved. I'd love to know what you came up with. Find me on LinkedIn, Twitter/X@JPGJournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.